the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
KYC, Know Your Customer, is the customer verification process that lets your bank or crypto exchange know who you are. Now, it's supposed to protect you from bad actors and allows authorities to track transactions, but the recent hack of Coinbase, where criminals bribed and recruited a group of rogue overseas support agents to steal customer data, it's a worrying example of how things can go wrong. In a statement this week, Coinbase said it received an email from an unknown source demanding $20 million to keep the breach of its internal data secret. Coinbase refused to pay the ransom demand. It issued a statement saying, instead, we are establishing a $20 million reward fund for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the criminals responsible for this attack. It does raise a very important and interesting question, though. Is KYC, Know Your Customer protocols, are they really that safe? Well, we're going to answer that question, and I'm speaking to Shiven Mudli, who's a macro strategist at 88. Let's try and understand what actually happened here, Shiven, and welcome back. This is quite stunning news. Coinbase apparently getting hacked, and the hackers demanding $20 million. I thought KYC was supposed to protect us against this kind of thing. What actually happened?
Hey, Kieran. Yeah, good to be back. I think there's a lot to dive in on the Coinbase side, and I think it differs quite a bit from Bybit's attack that happened in February, which was also quite a significant amount of money. But what's interesting is Coinbase taken for $20 million for the ransom, taken for, I would say, more. I think some articles are showing their cost could put them between $180 to $400 million, but the ransom was $20 million for that information. So what's interesting is KYC is quite a popular topic or just it's a system with the travel rule coming into place now. As well, everyone, every exchange, every CASP licensed FSP in South Africa has to abide by Know Your Client, KYC. And what's really interesting, and it's not to get wrong, is that KYC protects bad actors from getting into the ecosystem. It doesn't really protect the users from internal compromised situations. And this is a situation where the system was compromised in terms of social engineering and I would say insider threat with them bribing certain people because Coinbase used third-party providers for support agents and they were bribed, information was leaked. And but it's important to know that social engineering aspect, this is how it evolved. It because I would say Coinbase is custodial, meaning that they're holding the keys to their wallet. These customers were social engineered to transfer the funds to them. And I think you see these hacks and everyone who's listening might have experienced the situation with maybe Luno, for example. You receive an SMS from Luno saying, hey, your account is compromised. Please follow this link and stuff like that. That sort of information is obviously a case where you're socially engineered to transfer this funds away to these criminals.
Right. It does look like that there was some the statement issued by Coinbase says that it was involving some of their internal players. So they called them rogue agents in an overseas jurisdiction. They didn't go into any more details than that. So I would imagine, and for those who don't know, Coinbase is one of the largest crypto exchanges in the world. It is listed on the U.S. stock exchange as well. This is quite a hit to a company like that. And it's also quite a hit to the integrity of the whole crypto ecosphere in a way. Are there any better ways of doing KYC in your opinion? I mean, one of the solutions being proposed is decentralized identifiers secured by cryptography. Maybe explain what those are, and is this a potential solution?
Yeah, so it gets really interesting. So I really like this decentralized identifier, and what I wanted to touch on, was WorldCoin by Sam Altman. That WorldCoin has become quite popular, and it's sort of been like the backbone, but no one's really talking about it, but it's something that's in the space. And to a lot of our listeners that are listening today, it's this decentralized identifiers is this next gen of identity. It means this cryptography function where the user is in control, right? This user is controlled this information. It's not a centralized database. It can be selectively disclosed. There's a whole bunch of little fragments in this which gets really interesting, and where the benefit of this decentralized identity comes in is that even if, let's say, one agent in this case, Coinbase, if they use this technology, was maybe was impacted, right? So the node, something happened, compromises. What makes it difficult to get this identity is that the criminal will have to piece together all these fragmented pieces in cryptography technology in order to get some critical access to information. So while it does make it better, this friction and fragmentation makes it extremely hard for systems that are adopting this decentralized infrastructure. And I think, you know, into the next aspect, there might be cases where banks and other FSPs need to consider this technology in terms of what are you seeing on chain. And like, does in South Africa, for example, does the FSCA look at on-chain data? What is on-chain to them? What does on-chain mean? Because we really pull the trigger quite fast on the CASP license without really understanding what goes into actually monitoring a CASP and an FSP that has a CASP license.
Right. I mean, and there have been breaches of databases in South Africa. I think the banks are very, very good at this, to their credit, but they are centralized databases, from my understanding. And to the extent that do they use decentralized identifiers, I'm not quite sure. So that would be where you might want to disclose maybe your name, but you would have your account details in a separate database, which is distributed somewhere else in the world, maybe in many different places around the world. So anybody trying to hack that would have to get all of these different nodes where this data is stored and collect them and then process it through cryptography. Almost an impossible task, I would imagine. Not entirely impossible, maybe, but very, very difficult. Do you think we're going to start seeing some questions being asked about centralized storage of databases due to this Coinbase hack?
I do think so. I think we're internationally, yes, I think it'll be a more popular topic, particularly about, because obviously the SEC is gonna look at Coinbase quite with a tight lens there. And if we start looking at cases where like stable coins and other transactions start taking place in the network, what does it mean for the FATF organization, which is the Financial Action Task Force, as well as AML policies? What goes on from there? So AML being, okay, KYC comes in, it's preventing these bad actors that are looking at it. But the internal controls is, how are financial institutions and financial service providers evolving with the technology risk of AI to their businesses? So, for example, I was playing around with some AI agents the other day, and I was playing with a Llama open source model. And I was able to take some YouTube videos, around about 3 hours of content, then fine-tune the voice of this YouTuber, and then create a voice overtone to make calls from this YouTuber. And it's crazy to think that this technology exists right now in our fingertips. And if you're sophisticated enough, with enough time and obviously ambition to actually do something malicious, a $25 subscription is just quite a little to actually social engineer quite a lot of users who are uneducated about the risk and the financial risk, particularly dealing in crypto, dealing in this new financial world.
Yeah, deepfake has become quite sophisticated. And the idea that we're getting on top of this, even with the licensing regime that we have at the moment, I think it's a bit of a pipe dream because technology is steps ahead of the regulators. And I imagine the little experiment you described there where you were able to, clone the voice of a YouTuber and you could then start making phone calls and putting out messages or YouTube videos of your own. How do you protect against that, though?
That's a whole different game. And I think this is where this WorldCoin or Sam Altman's World ID sort of comes into play. And why I do say that is it's this instruction overall where we're seeing this proof of personhood, meaning that AI is advancing so much. And it became like a real, when World ID released like last year, 2 years ago, became like this popular topic that people were scanning their retinas through something called an orb, which then was generating a cryptographic person ID for people in certain jurisdictions to verify that you were human. And all of this was done via this technology called zero knowledge proofs. And in this case where, how do you verify that the other person exists? And I look at other agents and models now, some of them don't have that protection. Some of them are early stages where people were using their photos to generate headshots. They didn't realize that the information was being stored in their privacy data. There was little terms and conditions saying that they can use their images for whatever they want. And obviously, deepfakes, voices were all part of the model. So in this case, I think it's going to become extremely hard in terms of how do you verify? I think I'm still thinking about that idea as well. World ID has been something that's sort of taking that next step in looking at people personhood as well. But overall, I think you're going to look at things where, if someone calls you, can it verify that it was AI or you're speaking to a person? And I think I'm not that smart in the AI space to give you an answer there. But I think there's technology quietly being developed for this data security.
Now, I noticed that the Coinbase stock price didn't seem to suffer at all. I think there was a temporary dip there for a day or two, but it's up from about $150 to $266. Just in the last month. So clearly investors don't see this as a particularly big problem. Another project that is worth looking at, and I know you spend a lot of time on this, is Tron, which is a network for stable coins. Now, it hosts around $70 billion in Tether. It's an extraordinary amount of money. And Tether is the world's largest stablecoin issuer. Transaction activity on Tron now rivals Ethereum, which is the second largest crypto platform in the world after Bitcoin. So it's reflecting there's a growing role in real-world crypto payments, which Tron is trying to satisfy there. The Tron price in South African cents, it's very cheap. It's about five cents. And it's up more than 100% in the last 6 months or so. Explain why you're excited about Tron.
Yeah, Tron has been something on my radar. When I look at infrastructure, I've always been a utility player and a macro player from, our previous podcasts. I always state where the macro lies is sort of where I'm looking at. And one of the interesting things about Tron is when we start looking at protocols that are either staking on Tron, any sort of liquidity total value that's sort of locked in this network, what's interesting and what's growing is that we're seeing higher volume wallets that are using this ecosystem. So that means that institutions are likely bigger whales, and institutions are likely using this using the network to move funds either internally or externally in a space or any time like that. So that's what's really captured my eye. And when we start looking at the broader picture of networks, so Ethereum really positions itself as the security layer, sort of the backbone of finance. And we've seen larger institutions play in the Ethereum space. So just because of the security functionality, they've sort of sought that the network or the chain as that security function. And when we start moving into different segments of finance, Solana, USDC or USDT, they predominantly been on this case of this DeFi ecosystem, money moving fast, money moving efficiently, and a lot more finance, or how should I say, secondary to the main source of finance institutions. Solana's really been capturing that, and that's been growing over and all. But when we start looking at Tron as a network, Tron as a network really satisfies this growing demand of high-frequency functionality. And when we start seeing African countries really start to adopt any sort of dollar-based payments, whether it be stablecoin in this case, or African-based cryptocurrency, meaning a stablecoin of an African country, we might see the adoption of these rails grow. And this cross-border functionality where Tron really fits in satisfies that need. And I think this is where it gets interesting. And, you know, we were speaking off-air around technologies that being built. And one of the projects I'm invested in was a zero-knowledge proof offline wallet. And that was using also networks of how can you facilitate these transactions over Tron, which has really sort of sparked my interest and the growing utility of this network in the long run.
Yeah, you probably should explain what zero knowledge proof means. It's a bit of a new term for many people.
So zero knowledge proof in this case is, in its simplest form, is verifying something without giving you the answer. So for example, I belong to a clubhouse, and in this clubhouse, I don't want to give away the password. So I ask you a series of questions in which would tell me that you know somewhat of this password. And once that's done, it really verifies this transaction and you're allowed into the clubhouse in the simplest words. So in a case where you're looking at transactions that are offline, you would have this zero knowledge proof, which is an answer. And by showing this answer to another person and this person verifying your answer, it gives you the money into your account. And when you move back into the internet environment, it obviously it'll trigger back into the blockchain and layer the chain. And that's where the interesting part comes in. It's how are banks going to evolve as well with these zero knowledge proofs of, because we're seeing centralization of cryptocurrency right now. And I think the next big thing in stablecoins will be this anonymous decentralization of stablecoins. And I think it will become popular. This anonymity is something that's crucial because cryptocurrency was meant to be anonymous. And as it moves more centralization into the centralization space, this anonymity goes away. And I think the travel rule really satisfies that, takes away that anonymity. So I think that the next steps is actually looking at where does zero knowledge proofs come in? And I think we've just been exploring a lot more chains that are playing in the space of zero knowledge.
Yeah, because the banks, of course, they rely very much on KYC. And I'm just, you know, turning back to that for a second. However, there have been a number of very creative scams, which I've noticed over the last year or so. People are using what they call mules. So you'll get somebody who's got the ID, he's got a South African ID, so he can open up a bank account. But it's then used by scammers, bad actors. They rip off money, often using deep fake, pretending to be somebody else, convince you to hand over money or your password or something like that. Money's moved into the mule's bank account and it's cleaned out. So the banks themselves are not immune from this kind of thing going. And there's not, from what I've seen, they are not taking responsibility or liability for that. And legally, they're probably correct in not doing that. It just means that we have to be a lot more careful in who are we dealing with and who are we handing out information to. And even Poppia, the Poppia Act is not particularly going to protect us against that.
Yeah, agreed. I think there's there's two different, how should I say, fields developing in South Africa, and it's one where the FSCA needs to take control of in terms of the bad actors and the illegal immigrants that are participating in the market in South Africa, that are using South African residents to move money. There's major risk there, but in the long run, we see cases where there are good actors that have struggled in African country that are coming in to South Africa that need an infrastructure where they need to make a living. I think it's a human right. And in that case, we saw this happen in Ukraine-Russia war, where USDC used the functionality of this wallet infrastructure. And in the long run, I think there's going to definitely be two camps in this case, and how they look at it. I think the banks are right in saying that if you're not KYC'd and you're not a legitimate good actor, yes, we're not taking responsibility for that. But there's also going to come a case where the financial services providers in South Africa that are offering this non-custodial wallet, where, or non-custodial meaning that the person or the individual holds the keys to their own wallet, a similar case of a MetaMask is a good one, or Phantom Wallet, where you own your own keys. And with this case, they're allowed to transact. And we're seeing this evolution of MetaMask and Phantom Wallet, where they're integrating with Visa and MasterCard, allowing them to sort of do these payments, tap and go payments, because they have rails with these larger institutions. So yes, but in that case, how do you monitor where the money's coming from? And I think the next stage there is looking at on-chain data. I know FinServ has quite a significant amount of information on money moving through credit cards and debit cards and stuff like that.
FinServ being the financial surveillance unit owned by the part of the Reserve Bank.
So, I mean, the Reserve Bank is looking at like maybe on-chain analytics in terms of where money's moving, duration, location of money movement. I think we haven't gotten to that stage where our regulators fully understand how on-chain, and I could be misunderstood. I mean, from the conversations I had, I don't think they fully understood the benefits they could get from on-chain analytics, but I think they are aware of it. And there's things that obviously need to be looked at with more open eyes and just more thought around, you're going to have this transition. It's going to come, and you'd rather be prepared than just jump on a case where you pull the trigger too fast, exactly like CASP licenses. You don't want to act so fast and then it's just bad actors and you don't know how to regulate the market again.
Final question, Shivan. The Tether CEO, Paolo Ardoino, he recently said that he thought many European banks are likely to blow up in the next few years. And he says this because regulators, Tether was trying to get into the European market, and they decided against it. Regulators were pushing Tether, the largest stablecoin issuer in the world, to have 60% of their Tether dollars in uninsured cash deposits in banks in Europe. Effectively, what that means is the banks would be able to lend against Tether dollars under the fractional reserve banking system, a huge risk. You could end up with a Silicon Valley type situation, which blew up in the United States. And so he's anticipating something similar happening in Europe because of this. This is where regulators are really kind of standing on their own feet, aren't they?
What's really interesting there is, I think in a European case, I think Germany has sort of been that support system for many European countries by just opening up their fiscal policy in terms of the sort of different backings in that. But when looking at the bigger picture, I think I remember reading an article a while ago where USDT didn't enter the market, but they did acquire an investment through an Amsterdam-based fintech company that was dabbling in stablecoins in order to test the market. And what was interesting is that, yeah, I don't disagree with the CEO of Tether. I mean, the macroeconomic structure of Europe is quite uncertain in that they've had low rates for a very long time. The uncertainty in the long run is also quite, I should say, problematic, particularly with tariffs, the war that's going on just across Poland with Russia and Ukraine, oil coming into the market, gas, natural gas prices. I think they have a lot more infrastructure problems as well in that, meaning that more money supply would just go to more government spending because you've had mass migration into Europe and infrastructure in Europe really is unsustainable in this case. And I mean, we saw that from the right-wing party and comments in the UK as well. It's a case where the money might just go into fiscal policy spending, which may not really benefit the long run of their use case of Tether in the ecosystem. So I don't blame him. I don't think Europe is a sustainable market from an economics point.
Yeah, and I mean, just on that point, I think there's Trump has become quite hostile towards Europe, and there could be, and there's speculation about this, there could be a liquidity crunch for the European banks. They've often been bailed out is probably not the right word. They've been provided with liquidity in the past by the United States. Happened in 2008 in the financial crisis and one or two times after that. But Trump's hostility might actually put a little bit of a squeeze, and then you could have interest rates climbing, and that would trigger off a whole lot of economic crises, if you like. I can see why the Tether CEO is saying this, that there's a potential for a blow up in the European banks.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't see Europe in any other way. I think the tariff implications, the trade war implications, I know Europe, he's still yet to talk to Europe. I know there was apparently a trade deal with the UK coming out sometime soon. But looking at Europe overall, I think a stronger euro does impact the market quite significantly in terms of just their lending rates overall, because most European countries are struggling with the housing crisis at present. So I think there's a lot of macro factors that are pointing to a blow up of the European economy. But how President Lagarde actually navigates that situation is yet to be seen, and I think low rates might be something they look at for maybe over the medium term as they continue. But obviously the parity in euro dollar has obviously diverged quite a bit, but also interest rate divergence with the Fed and the ECB might widen a bit more, just on the talks of the Fed looking at keeping rates a bit more stagnant, whereas Europe would likely cut rates. That divergence obviously opens up a whole new can of worms altogether.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That was Shivan Mudli, macro strategist at 88. Thanks very much for joining us, Shivan.
Thanks, Kiran. Thanks for having me, and looking forward to the next one.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kiran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.